This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The World Health Organization says Israel has carried out over 400 attacks on Gaza's healthcare sector during its genocidal war, killing nearly 700 people. Hamas says Israel is deliberately trying to derail ceasefire talks to buy time and push ahead with its genocidal campaign in Gaza. And the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution condemns the West for its silence on the ongoing Israeli onslaught against the people of Gaza. More than 5 months into Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza, and the regime continues to strike and claim more civilian lives across the territory. The latest Israeli airstrikes killed over a dozen civilians, including at least two children in northern and southern Gaza. Palestinian sources said another air raid on a home east of Rafah city killed at least six civilians. An Israeli airstrike also targeted a home west of Gaza city, killing a mother and son. Israeli military drones also targeted a group of civilians east of the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza, killing three civilians and wounding 10 others. The Israeli genocide has so far killed nearly 32,000 civilians and has left over 74,000 injured. 7,000 are also unaccounted for and feared buried under rubble. The World Bank says more than half of Gaza's population, including the children and elderly, is on the brink of famine, calling for urgent action to save lives. Meanwhile, an international rights organization has called for urgent global measures to stop the ongoing Israeli massacre of Palestinians, especially Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital. The Euromed Human Rights Monitor says regime forces have killed at least 100 Palestinians at the hospital surrounding so far. It added, survivors' accounts show that many of those killed were victims of extrajudicial executions after their arrest. It said regime is still arbitrarily detaining hundreds of civilians for three straight days now, including medical staff and immobile patients. The Euromed said the international community must intervene immediately and put an end to Israel's atrocities that have been ongoing for the last 3 days. It's also called for an international committee to be set up to probe Israel's war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. The World Health Organization says it's documented 410 Israeli attacks on Gaza's healthcare sector since the regime's genocidal war started in October. According to the World Body's latest figures, regime's attacks on the sector have left 685 people dead and 902 injured. Israel strikes have also damaged 99 healthcare facilities and 104 ambulances across Gaza. It added two-fifths of the Israeli attacks took place in Gaza City, a quarter in the northern Gaza, and another quarter in southern city of Khan Yunis. Emphasizing healthcare sector should not be a target in armed conflicts, the WHO urged the Israeli regime to respect international law, which calls for active protection of civilians and healthcare facilities. Volunteer medics have been working hard to provide aid to Palestinians since the beginning of Israel's onslaught. They often describe the situation and the besieged territory as horrific, genocidal, and inhumane. And recently, a British surgeon who spent some time in Gaza shared his distressing observations in an interview with reporters.
And I spent 2 weeks at Al-Aqsa Hospital, and I think it's fair to say I wasn't remotely prepared for what I saw. I saw the most appalling atrocities And I saw things that I never would have expected to have seen in any healthcare setting. Some days we didn't have any surgical gloves, so we had to wash previous ones. Sometimes we had no surgical drapes. Many days we had no morphine. On many occasions, no antibiotics. So really limited resources. Knowing that actually a lot of that, those resources were probably in depots somewhere or maybe in lorries queuing up outside at Rafa, but could not be distributed. And this is what is so urgent about the need for a ceasefire, is that the only way that aid that's being delivered to Gaza, and we welcome every bit of aid, the only way that aid is going to get to where it's needed is if there is a ceasefire. Spent some time a while ago looking up the definition of genocide in a variety of dictionaries, and what is going on in Gaza fulfills every single definition of genocide that I have read.
A senior Hamas leader has slammed the Israeli regime for deliberately trying to derail ceasefire talks. Osama Hamdan says Israel will not achieve in negotiations what it's failed to accomplish on the battlefield in Gaza.
In every round of negotiations, they escalate their crimes against our people, believing that by committing such crimes, they might achieve, make some achievements on the negotiating table. And here we underscore once again that what the occupation did not succeed in getting via the military confrontations, and in light of the genocidal crimes, they will not take this by negotiations. The movement is striving with all efforts in order to end this war of aggression against our people and is intensifying its effort. The movement is therefore following the negotiation track via the brothers in Egypt and Qatar, and the movement submitted a complete vision according to the principles which we consider to be necessary for an agreement, which fulfill, or these visions fulfill, the priorities of our people and resistance in ending the aggression and the return of the displaced to the places where they had shelter, and the withdrawal of the occupation forces completely from the Gaza Strip, and also allowing for more aid and assistance to come in and to launch the reconstruction process. The movement also
Hamdan was addressing a presser in Lebanon. He said Hamas is doing everything possible to reach an agreement that will be favorable to all Palestinians. He, however, said the Israeli regime is buying time to continue with its genocidal campaign in Gaza. He underlined Hamas has shown greater flexibility against the stubbornness of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Elsewhere in his speech, Hamdan said the regime's trying to make Gaza unlivable by destroying civilian infrastructure. He also condemned Israeli assassination of a Hamas official charged with the security of Gaza. He was pointing to the killing of Fayyuq al-Mabou, head of police and aid coordinator, during the regime's raid on Al-Shifa Hospital on Sunday. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the enemies have long attempted to bring the country's economy to collapse, but to no avail. Ayatollah Khamenei added that Iran has witnessed outstanding improvements in various domains over the past year, despite efforts by the enemies to instill hopelessness among people. He made the remarks on the occasion of the Persian New Year, where he elaborated on this year's slogan, "A surge in production through people's participation." He underlined growth in production will only be possible with everyone's participation. Ayatollah Khamenei further highlighted the great capacities that Iran enjoys, noting such potential, if properly tapped into, will ensure further economic prosperity. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader touched on Israel's genocidal war, calling it the most pressing issue before the world. The leader added the bloodshed unfolding in Gaza exposes the true face of so-called advanced Western civilization. He said West has not only been standing idly by in face of the massacre of Palestinians, but it's also been complicit in supporting Israel both financially and militarily. Ayatollah Khamenei also praised the resistance front, saying Events happening in West Asia have revealed the capacity and power of resistance against Zionism. He added, regional resistance groups have thwarted the plots of the Israeli regime and its Western backers, particularly the United States. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank have held a funeral for three young men killed in an Israeli airstrike in the city of Jenin. Three Palestinians were killed after the Israelis struck their car. Israeli forces carried out incursions into the West Bank, and they've been doing so on an almost daily basis, but they've intensified violent attacks across occupied territory since October the 7th, when the regime launched its campaign of genocide on Gaza. According to Palestinian sources, nearly 450 people have been killed and thousands abducted during Israeli raids into occupied cities and towns ever since. The Palestine Football Association has called on the football's international governing body, FIFA, to impose sanctions against Israeli teams for the regime's genocide in Gaza. The Palestinian Association said six other member nations have endorsed this proposal, asking FIFA to put an end part to put it on the agenda, I should say, of the upcoming FIFA Congress in May. It had regime's onslaughts killed nearly 100 footballers and destroyed or seriously damaged the entire football infrastructure of Gaza in clear violation of international law. Palestinian officials said at least five football clubs based in Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank are members of the regime's football association. They said such inclusion implicitly recognizes Israeli sovereignty over the settlements, which goes against international law and FIFA's obligations. The Israeli military has admitted that a missile fire from Yemen hit the vicinity of Eilat port in occupied territories, and it came after the Yemeni army spokesman announced the operation against the port.
The missile forces also launched a number of winged missiles at Israeli targets in the Umm al-Rashash area in southern occupied Palestine.
Yahya Saidi said that a cruise missile was launched from Yemen's territorial waters in the Red Sea toward occupied territories, and that regime's Iron Dome and Arrow missile defense systems failed to intercept it. There's still no report of casualties or damage, as the Israelis claim missile fell in an unpopulated area. The head of the Eilat port told media ship traffic at the port has been paralyzed since Yemen's anti-Israel operations in the Red Sea started back in mid-November. He said every month between 12 and 13 ships entered and departed this port, but now that number is down to zero. Yemen's foreign ministry has censured the UN Security Council for issuing a statement against the country's naval operations in the Red Sea. The 15-member body discussed the Red Sea this week, despite repeated declarations by the Yemenis that the operations are mainly targeting Israeli or Israeli-linked ships in a show of solidarity with Palestinians and against the regime's campaign of genocide in Gaza. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has your details out of Sana'a.
Yemen's foreign ministry has reacted strongly to a statement recently issued by the UN Security Council deploring attacks on vessels linked to Israel, as well as American and British assets in the Red Sea, and demanded the authorities in Sana'a to immediately halt such assaults. The ministry lambasted the 15-member council, saying Yemen's naval actions are only aimed at supporting Palestinians. It said the UNSC move reflects the body's submission to America's interests and its support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza.
The Security Council usually stands by American, British and Zionist policies and implements their agenda, but at the same time fails to stop the Israeli massacres of the people of Palestine. Therefore, the Republic of Yemen considers any statements from the Security Council non-existent. Sana'a continues its efforts to support Palestinians in accordance with the will of the people in Yemen. The armed forces are also targeting American, British, and Israeli ships as Yemen stands alongside the axis of resistance in the fight against the axis of evil, and we will prevail, God willing.
Officials highlighted that Yemen's operations in the Red and Arabian Seas are motivated by the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza and enjoy support not only from Yemenis but also from the freedom-seeking people worldwide.
The Security Council's statement is futile and is part of American policy, meaning that a council tries to appease the United States and Britain at the expense of the blood of innocent Palestinians. We support Palestinians not only from the humanitarian angle, but there is a brotherly bond between Yemenis and the people of Palestine. Our actions are in retaliation for the ongoing Israeli genocide.
Meanwhile, the army spokesperson announced an assault on yet another American vessel, Mado, in the Red Sea, using multiple missiles. It also reported attacks on Israeli targets in the occupied territories, including the one near Eilat port that has also been confirmed by the Israeli military. The Yemeni army launched its anti-Israel operations in mid-November. It has, though, repeatedly announced that all other ships are free and safe to sail through the strategic waterway. However, recently they have also targeted American and British ships and retaliation for the two countries' aggression against Yemen.
People here say that during US-backed years-long war on Yemen, the UN Security Council turned a blind eye to the war crimes committed against Yemenis. Therefore, they argue that the military action is the only way to deter the aggressors, as Western hegemonic countries only understand the language of force, not dialogue. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has said the Biden administration greenlighted the Israeli regime's massacre of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. She denounced Washington's arms aid to Israel as state-sponsored violence. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. China's Xinhua news agency has covered this story and tells us more. The United Nations human rights chief has expressed dismay concerning the brutality with which the Israeli regime is leading its ongoing months-long war of genocide in Gaza. Volker Türk told the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland, on Thursday, 29th of February, there appear to be no bounds to and new words to capture the horrors that are unfolding before our eyes in Gaza. Tens of thousands of Palestinians, many of them women and children, have been massacred as a result of the Israeli military's onslaught in Gaza. Israel launched its campaign on 7th of October last year, following the Al-Aqsa storm operation, a surprise operation by Gaza's resistance movement against the occupied Palestinian territories. Volker Turk condemned the brutality of the Israeli response as appalling and entirely wrong. Meanwhile, the UN official warned about the pending dire consequences of a ground invasion that the Israeli regime has threatened to stage against the southern Gaza city of Rafah. More than 1.5 million of Gaza's 2.4 million plus population have fled to Rafah in southern Gaza Strip, finding nowhere else safe across the coastal sliver. Volker Turk said such a ground assault would contravene the orders issued by the United Nations highest court. On 26th of January, the International Court of Justice at The Hague, Netherlands, said Israel had to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of the Genocide Convention. Volker Turk said, "I fail to see how such an operation could be consistent with the binding provisional measures issued by the International Court of Justice. The prospect of an Israeli ground assault on Rafah would take the nightmare being inflicted on the Palestinians of Gaza into a new dimension." Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story. The European Union has wrapped a recent unjustifiable attack by the Israeli occupation forces on Palestinian civilians seeking food aid in the besieged Gaza Strip, calling for an international investigation into the deadly incident. In a statement on Saturday, 2nd of March, the European Union foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, condemned the restrictions imposed by Israel on the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza and the opening of Gaza's crossing points. He said the firing by Israeli troops on civilians trying to access foodstuff is unjustifiable. Josep Borrell added, "We request an impartial international investigation on this tragic event, allowing for a clear picture of the events and responsibilities." At least 112 people were martyred and more than 750 others were injured on Thursday, 29th of February, as the Israeli military opened fire on Palestinians who had surrounded a convoy of 38 aid trucks in Gaza, with the Palestinian Health Ministry calling the incident a massacre. The latest Israeli crime comes as non-governmental organizations and United Nations experts have on several occasions voiced fears of famine in Gaza. Gaza has been completely cut off from aid by the Israeli regime since October of last year. The European Union foreign policy chief Josep Borrell emphasized that Israel shoulders responsibility of complying with the rules of international law and to protect the distribution of humanitarian aid to the civilian population of Gaza. The top EU diplomat pointed out, "The responsibility for this incident lays on the restrictions imposed by the Israeli army and obstructions by violent extremists to the supply of humanitarian aid." Josep Borrell warned that the restrictions on the entry of humanitarian assistance contribute to creating scarcity, hunger and disease, saying it would also lead to a level of desperation that brings about violence. He added, "Unabated fighting and disregard for international humanitarian law will lead to complete chaos, making the distribution of humanitarian aid impossible." Josep Borrell stressed the need to restore a minimum of order and security in Gaza to preserve a humanitarian space. Borrell added, "We urge Israel to fully cooperate with the United Nations agencies and other humanitarian actors involved in the humanitarian response, and to allow free, unimpeded and safe humanitarian access through all crossing points in Gaza." The EU's top diplomat also urged Israel to swiftly remove the obstacles at the Kerem Shalom crossing and opened access in the north at Karni and Eretz crossings to open the port of Ashdod to humanitarian aid and to allow a direct humanitarian corridor from Jordan into Gaza. He emphasized that airdrops should be a solution of last resort given their minimal impact and their risk to civilians. Borrell also urged the United Nations Security Council to call for an urgent cessation of hostilities in Gaza. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has said the Biden administration greenlighted the Israeli regime's massacring of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Ilhan Omar denounced Washington's arms aid to Israel, calling it state-sponsored violence. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar made the statement at a press conference on Thursday, 29th of February, along with other U.S. lawmakers, including Representative Rashida Tlaib, Democrat of Michigan, as she voiced concerns about the high death toll of Palestinian civilians and the displacement of over 1 million people in the Gaza Strip, criticizing the Biden administration for approving additional aid to Israel without congressional approval. Ilhan Omar said, "This administration cannot claim to be an honest broker of peace while greenlighting the massacring of Palestinians in Gaza. The restocking of Israel's arsenal is not foreign policy, it is state-sponsored violence waged against defenseless families who want only to live in peace." Ilhan Omar stressed, "If we truly want to uplift humanity to protect the innocent people of Gaza, to bring hostages safely home, to hold out hope for peace, then we must demand a ceasefire in Gaza right now." Ilhan Omar also expressed disappointment with the response from the United States and the world's political leaders to Israeli atrocities in Gaza, underlining that empty rhetoric about human rights without any meaningful action is unacceptable. The Democratic congresswoman from Minnesota said the Biden administration's policies lack effective pressure on Israel and fail to deter the Israeli regime from continuing with its crimes against Palestinians. Ilhan Omar added, "Despite the clarity surrounding Gaza's despair, the response from political leaders has been nothing short of callous. Empty rhetoric about human rights ring hollow when no action follows." She added, "This administration's policies fail to meaningfully pressure the Israeli regime through restrictions, sanctions, or any hint of consequences. Each war crime and violation compiled by journalists, human rights groups, and United Nations agencies are bearing witness."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arabic English Radio. Thank you very much for joining us in today's episode of Muslim Lady. Well, this is Asma, your host. Once more, I have the pleasure to be in this studio. And here with me, I have Sister Rehana. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Assalamu alaikum to our dear listeners. I'm very happy to be here. And of course, Ramadan Kareem to all of my
yes, of course.
Muslim
Thank
friends
you for bringing
all over the
that
world.
Up. So that's very amazing. Ramadan Kareem to you and to everyone who's listening to us, and especially to the Muslim ladies. I think when the holy month of Ramadan comes, all the mothers and all the Muslim ladies are going to go through too much. Whatever they do is going to be doubled up. So before we get into our discussion, I just want you to introduce yourself very much briefly for those who still are not familiar with you.
I'm Rehana Paisapal, and I'm an Islamic researcher, especially on women's issues in today's age. And I am also a mother.
Ah, that's very amazing. In today's episode, we're going to talk about something which is unfortunately something that has been common. Nowadays, in today's world, we see that the first problem that gets in the life of couples, the first solution that they get to meet is divorce. And divorce is not an easy thing in a religion. Like, you have to give it a second thought, a third thought, and not very quickly get into it. I'm sure there are a lot of alternatives to and a lot of solutions in order for divorce to get away, like for this choice to fade away and not to be considered as a choice, which is, I guess, about the relationship between the couples, like how they could moderate the situation so that they would not get into divorce from an Islamic perspective, of course.
In Islam, divorce is one of the things that is permissible, but has been very much condemned.
Yeah.
So it is not to be taken lightly at all whatsoever. However, in today's society, we see that it has become more common for couples to resort to this way whenever they get into a dispute or they feel they've reached a dead end, so to speak.
But religiously speaking, it's the last solution. Like, you have tried all the situations, all the solutions, all the ways to get out of this entanglement, and then the last choice is divorce.
Exactly. And there is a narration from Imam Ali, peace be upon him, that says, "Among that which Allah has made permissible, there is nothing he hates more than divorce. And Allah hates a man who divorces and marries many women." So it is permissible as a last resort. However, it must not be taken lightly at all.
Exactly. In order to get a clear slate in here, let's just talk about the reasons and the ways that are going to lead to divorce. Like, what happens in a family? Because, you know, this institution, family institution, is not an easy thing to be broken, to be destroyed. So what happens to a married life in which they get to this decision that, okay, divorce is the best way?
Well, there are some reasons that we will mention, of course. But it is important to note that for all of these reasons that we're going to mention, we're going to talk about the ways that Islam has
suggested.
Yeah, the ways that Islam has suggested to, first of all, prevent these problems from occurring in the first place, because, of course, prevention is the best remedy. And secondly, to resolve these situations, resolve any disputes if they occur. Because, well, it's very possible, of course, for a married couple to have disputes at one point or another in their life.
Yeah, that's very common. Yes. I mean, like, siblings even get into a dispute. They would even hate each other for a temporary time. But the thing is that they would not get to cut each other from their existence.
Yes, exactly. It happens to everyone, of course. In any relationship, you might have a falling out for a short period. And the important thing to remember is to not give up. One of the things, one of the reasons that people mention when they give reasons for divorce is when they lose attraction for each other. So it can happen.
Which is very normal, I guess.
Yes,
like after a certain time, after a certain span of time, we're going to get used to each other. at first, when a relationship is going to start, when a life is going to be built, you have some attraction for each other, like, this is a new world, I'm a new world. So it's like you're going to discover another universe. So for sure, after a short time, you will come to this point that, okay, he or she is just somebody like me. We are so ordinary people, like we have our flaws, we can err sometimes, we're prone to err, and we're not all beautiful. It's not all about the good features that I have. Sometimes I might turn into a monster. So these things are very, real.
Yes, but I would like to separate it into two different parts.
Mm-hmm.
The first part is, well, the passion and the honeymoon phase, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
That just ends after a short while. So this is one side of it. The honeymoon phase ends eventually, and it happens in every relationship.
The title says it all.
Yes, so it ends. And I believe the reason that, perhaps mostly in the world of celebrities, the reason that we see their marriages ending so quickly after 2 years or 1 year...
In a blink of an eye.
Yeah, I think that is the main reason for their divorces. So,
like the honeymoon phase ends.
Exactly. So that first period where there is lots of passion, that just ends eventually, obviously. It can't last forever.
Still, we are in the introductory phase, and we went to the point that, okay, one of the factors that will lead to divorce is the fact that maybe the honeymoon phase is ending and we're meeting the reality, we're facing the reality, and sometimes this reality is not as beautiful as we have imagined that in our mind.
Well, we said that there must be a distinction when people say that the reason for their divorce is loss of attraction, or we just, some celebrities say we lost our spark. We must make the distinction between, firstly, the honeymoon phase ending. And for that, I believe the solution that Islam gives is to get married with an open eye and to decide not just with your heart, but also with your logic, with
exactly.
your brain. So, because eventually the couple will see reality, they mm-hmm. will meet reality and see the flaws of one another. And yeah. if the only reason that they got married was because of an initial attraction and they ignored all of the red flags, all of the incompatibilities, just because they were in love, so to speak.
Yeah, like then, building castle. Whenever they say, I fell in love and then we married and then we come now to divorce, I just remember that building castles in the sky. Like you have a balloon of hallucination in your mind and then reality comes and prick that balloon. Because you have to face this reality that we all are human beings and nobody is perfect. This is the very first step.
Exactly. We're going to eventually see the realities. We're going to live in reality after the honeymoon phase ends. So after that, we must have some other foundation to continue building the relationship other than that initial passion and love.
The spark.
Yes, the spark. Exactly. So for that, Islam actually, the criteria that Islam offers when looking for a partner is very logical. So it's very much based in logic. And it tells men and women to choose their husbands and wives wisely and choose people who are at the same level in different ways. So inshallah, we will have other episodes talking about what criteria we must have when choosing a spouse. But that is for another episode, inshallah.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
So firstly, we must choose our spouse wisely so that there's something to build the relationship on.
Right now we're talking about the factors. So the honeymoon phase ends. This is one of the factors, like you're facing the reality. Another factor?
Another factor is when people say, okay, so we've realized the realities, we're continuing our lives together, and then after a while, we just lose our attraction. They say, oh, we've grown apart, and we just don't have that spark anymore. Another reason for that is that the spouses don't spend enough quality time together.
I guess they do not know how, they're not skilled enough to have communication with each other.
Yes, and to maintain that attraction. Yeah. Attraction must be maintained through acts of love.
Yeah, that's the way it is.
Exactly. So that is it. Like, after they get married, the couple might just stop trying. They think that it has to go naturally, but
they,
it's something
they take
you
everything
build.
For granted.
Exactly. So we must actually be actively building that love and passion throughout the relationship. And sometimes it's it might be hard work. Maybe
of course it is. You see, the marriage in itself is a concept that is very difficult. When I usually see people abruptly getting into marriage, I just wonder, how this quickly? How? Because, you know, you have to give a second thought to everything. So relationship is not something that you get into it, like you jump off the cliff and throw yourself into it and then let it go the way it is. Go by the currents. No, it's not like that. You have to spend time. You have to concentrate, focus. You have to give it all your heart and love and life.
Yeah, so that is it. It's hard work sometimes.
Of course.
But
yeah,
you have to put in the work to have a happy and long marriage. And something else that plays a role here, maybe the couple lose interest because of factors outside of their relationship.
Like, for example?
For example, as is depicted in many movies and stories.
They depict it perfectly, actually.
Yeah. We see that a lot of times marriages end because one person, maybe, starts to find attractiveness in someone outside of the marriage. So because of that, they slowly start to lose interest in their own spouse.
And
which,
by the way, why do you think this happens? Like, I mean, you're married, you're devoted and committed to a to an institution. Why would you go and search your happiness somewhere else?
I believe maybe it's not always the case that they actively search for it outside of the family.
So you mean unconsciously that happens?
Yes. I think that a lot of the times it happens unconsciously, and the way to prevent it, as we talked about in our previous episode, I believe, is the concept of hijab.
Lower your gaze.
Exactly. For men to lower their gaze, and women, of course.
Of course, yes.
To observe hijab for women, to prevent other men from becoming disheartened from their wives, maybe.
Yes, exactly.
To cover your beauty. And, of course, the hijab in your mannerism towards non-mahram people. So if men and women observed hijab in their behavior and do not get close and too friendly with non-mahram people, then that would prevent a connection, an emotional connection happening with someone outside of the marriage.
Yeah.
So we see
and
a lot
they would
of times.
Save the lives of other women.
Exactly.
Now, as Muslim ladies, we have to back each other up. Like, we have to be a
girl
help
code
for each other. Exactly. So up until now, we talked about some factors that would lead to divorce, and unfortunately, we're running out of time. So in other episodes, we're going to cover more and more of reasons and solutions. But until now, thank you, Sister Rehane, and thank you, dear listeners. This is all for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting. Waiting for something, something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Ayahs, 30 days. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. A monotheist person not only reflects on the Noble Quran, but also tries to explain the ayahs of these heavenly scriptures to others and make them familiar with its teachings. Explicating of the Quranic teachings, first of all, was the duty of the Prophet and his infallible successors, every faithful too, according to the extent that they had learned from the Ahlul Bayt, embarked on this heavy duty. So, the ulama that are Muslim scholars took over this duty after the occultation of the 12th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, and have seriously continued this job till the present day. Today, this duty has become highly important due to the broad assault of enemies against the beliefs of Islam and humanity. Today, in the 9th episode of the Ramadan special series, you will hear on a principle in Islam, which is very important for having a healthy society. This principle is enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil. This topic will be explained with a focus on ayahs 163 to 166 of Surah A'raf. Stay tuned, please. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said in his sermon on the final day of Sha'ban and the week of Ramadan, "Whoever refrains from disturbing people in this month, Almighty Allah will keep his wrath away from him." In September 1988, in one of the Chicago subway stations, a woman was raped. She asked help from people, but the onlookers would pass by indifferently. Only a man cooperated with police to arrest the culprit. What is astounding in this event was the reaction of the passers-by and onlookers rather than the rape itself. Professor Michael Cook, British historian and lecturer of Princeton University, US, wrote after reading the story on newspaper, "After reading the issue, I thought, if we have any duty to prevent others from doing indecent act towards our fellow humans, is the behavior of others related to us?" Michael reached to the conclusion that there is no name for this duty in the West, and the word help also fails to explain it. He notices in his studies that there are orders on this in one of the divine religions. These orders are called enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil. Thus, Michael authored a book in 2000 titled Enjoining What is Good and Forbidding What is Evil in the Islamic Thought. Feeling responsibility towards others and society is a sign of growth and sublimity of society. An advanced society is not the one where technology is in a high level, but a society where individuals feel responsibility towards each other and are not indifferent to social problems. This is a living and dynamic society. The Noble Quran says that Luqman, the sage, told his son to bid others to do good deeds and prevents them from evil deeds. God explains one of the clear examples of this social principle in Surah A'raf. The Israelites were dispersed on land after entering Beit al-Muqaddas. A group of them decided to live along the coast of the Red Sea. Among the instructions of the Torah was to appoint Saturday as the holiday and the day of repose. The fishers of the region, however, noticed that fat and big fish would approach the coast on Saturdays. Did the fish realize the difference between Saturday and other weekdays? Or it was God's command to test people? The fishers of Israelites thought of doing something to feign obedience of Allah's command while catching the best fish. Therefore, they built a small ponds along the coast with waterways leading to the sea. They would open the waterways on Saturday, and many fish would enter them. But when returning home in the evening, they would close the waterways and catch the fish on Sunday. On Sunday, they would say, "God has ordered us not to fish, so we have not fished. We have just entrapped them in ponds." At first, they committed this sin with a religious justification. But little by little, the sin lost its ugliness in their eyes, and they dared to disrespect Saturday. Gradually, fishers engaged in fishing very brazenly and earned a lot of money. The Noble Quran says after this ignominious act in Ayah 163 of Surah A'raf, "Ask them about the town that was situated on the seaside. When they violated the Sabbath day visibly on the shore, but on days when they were not keeping Sabbath, they would not come to them. Thus, did we test them because of the transgressions they used to commit?" A group of people decided to prevent them from this act, yet some others among the faithful preferred to keep silent, saying that there was no use in forbidding what is evil. They said, "Why do you advise a people whom Allah will destroy or punish with a severe punishment?" The former group answered, "As an excuse before your Lord, and with the hope that they may be God-weary." Now, the point to note here is that God says, on the fate of these groups, "So when they forgot what they had been reminded of, we delivered those who forbade evil conduct and seized the wrongdoers with a terrible punishment because of the transgressions they used to commit." Dear listeners, here God says that only those who forbade evil deeds were saved, and both those who committed evil deeds and those who were silent were punished. Enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil have their roots in the Quran, the practice of the Prophet, and the wisdom. It is interesting that God mentions the name of two creatures which have enjoined what is good and forbidden what is evil. One is ant. In Surah Naml, we read that an ant said to other ants, "O ants, enter your dwellings, lest Solomon and hosts should trample you while you are unaware." The other creature is the hoopoe, which is the time of Prophet Solomon came to him and reported from the land of Sheba. The hoopoe said to Solomon that the people of Sheba were worshipping the sun instead of Allah. Thus, this report on the wrong deed of the people of Sheba led to their belief in God's religion after their queen came to Solomon and realized truth and the right path. An important example of enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil are the officials, elites, and those who are called influencers in society. If they do something wrong, ordinary people will be affected and will do wrong acts more easily. Imam Ali, peace upon him, recommends people to advise their rulers. He knew that if this principle is not internalized on society, some will violate good deeds and promote evil ones, while no one protests them. This happened several decades later when people kept silent against Yazid and his flagrant indecency. Ultimately, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, embarked on this great obligation and rose up against Yazid, which led to his martyrdom and the captivity of women and children from his family and relatives. Imam Hussein said among his companions, "O people, the Messenger of God said, whoever sees a wrongdoing ruler making God's haram as halal, opposing the breaching God's covenant, opposing the practice of God's apostle, treating God's servants oppressively, yet he does not oppose this ruler verbally or practically, it deserves for Allah to put him where he puts that ruler, in hell." Imam Hussein, peace upon him, said on the philosophy of his uprising, "I have risen up for enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil and reforming my ancestors' ummah." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, continued Imam Hussein's path when he staged the greatest revolution of the 20th century and the most effective movement during the age of laicism and atheism. His uprising was a clear example of enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil. The world had gone astray when Imam Khomeini jolted conscience to wake up to stand against oppression and corruption. Like his ancestor, Imam Hussein, Imam Khomeini realized that the greatest evil is the corrupt and oppressive ruler who leads society in the wrong way.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.